Welcome to Communicating Care, a podcast of the Just Transition Collaborative at the University of Colorado Boulder, where we talk about the ways environmental and climate justice advocacy are motivated by, express, and foster care. On this podcast, we listen more deeply to people who have made headlines for making a difference, to learn from their insights for successful creative climate communication and behavior change. I'm the host, Professor Phaedra Pezzullo. Today, our guest is Kaylin, more publicly known as Hell on Wheels, a disability and complex trauma educator and advocate. As both someone living with a rare and progressive collection of genetic disabilities, as well as a survivor of child exploitation, she provides social and medical education on each, but particularly where they intersect. She's most known for creating an accessibility-focused straw chart in 2018, which is why I've asked her to talk with me today. Thank you for being on this podcast, Kaylin. How are you feeling today?
Hi, I am hanging in there. I will say up front to future listeners that this week in particular, I've had some difficulty with some seizures returning. So my speaking voice, I tend to be a little bit more articulate, a little clearer than I typically am today. I'm struggling a little bit for words here and there. And secondly, this is completely unrelated, but this is being recorded from my home and having a little bit of a neighbor issue at the moment. So if things get a little chaotic or I'm additionally distracted, I apologize in advance.
Thank you, Kaylin. Yes, I hope all listeners to this podcast are used to my low-tech approach. So sometimes there are dogs barking and cats meowing and neighbors. So hopefully people will roll with us. Well, I'd like to start these podcasts with a bit of background. I'm wondering, what is your training as an educator or who have been some of your important formal or informal teachers?
Yeah. So I will say off the top as well that I don't have any formal training. I consider myself as being someone who's kind of somewhat trained by osmosis of those around me. I do come from a family of teachers. So my aunt is one, my mom attempted to be one, found out it wasn't quite the environment for her, but she's always been a teacher at heart. Even when I was very young, that was kind of her style of just engaging with the world. And then kind of as I grew up, I'd say that I learned a whole lot because of my background. I spent a lot of time in inpatient settings and teaching hospitals. And so there was a lot of teaching happening there for students. And I kind of got to witness what works, what doesn't work when someone is looking like they're paying attention, but they're absolutely not following anything that you're saying versus when it's really effective. And then when I became an online person looking to advocates and, you know, currently the Amanis, as I like to think of them, Amani Barberin and Blair Amani, for different things and different reasons, they certainly lead the way. But even when I was younger, I was lucky enough to become semi-distant, but semi-close friends with Claire Wineland. She has cystic fibrosis and, you know, was very much a death positivity advocate. And that spoke to me even early on from the kind of education that I like to do, the kind of heart that I like to lead with. And so like those kinds of folks were kind of out front and center. But I would also say, as somebody who has a rare collection of disabilities, as well as a very abnormal life experience growing up, I found even as a teenager that most folks have no concept for the life that I was living and found myself online very, very early. I'm 35 now, but I was online and writing publicly things at 15. Like I was at the edge of that curve and found my niche probably very, very early on as being passionate about helping folks understand this is what my life is like. This is the mental health that I'm struggling with. This is the physical health that I'm experiencing. This is the reality of folks with a life like mine. And that kind of followed me through each stage of my life and progressed and kind of sharpened and fine-tuned. And I got more education and then I got more clarity. Like it just kind of built from there, kind of to a bit of the stature that I'd say that I'm at now. So that's kind of been my progress.
What a rich answer. Okay, so since 2017 already feels like a million years ago, at least to me. Let's take our listeners back to that moment. So at that time, Trump was the US president and he was openly mocking disabilities as a punchline on his campaign trail. Can you share a bit about how Trump's presidency impacted disabled people?
Admittedly, that is an upfront a little hard for me to answer. I feel like when I think back to that time, I go into a bit of like a stunned state of frozen disbelief and I almost shut down. It just feels like a different lifetime, but I suppose therein is the answer. It was truly traumatic for so many of us. The level of hate, the derision, the rallying and open acceptance for a leader to regularly make it okay to think less of us was nothing short of horrifying to witness. We were already considered subhuman to a lot of folks, but particularly a lot of that base due to our inability to quote unquote contribute in the same way. But now it was being very accepted and kind of cool to denigrate in such a public fashion. But I would say that even worse than that was how the returned disdain for him specifically brought out a lot of ableism in all sides, because now it was acceptable or okay so long as it was directed at him. If it was at his expense, it was acceptable. And we saw it every time he tripped, if he stumbled on stairs, if he tried to use a cup, just said something that made no sense, even when he got COVID. Or even the most broad one, the jokes about him wearing diapers or being incontinent, those kinds of things. We as disabled people became the punchline along with him. While he may have been the direct target, we had to sit and watch mockery in our quote unquote allies at that point, or for all for any other people with those needs and difficulties and challenges. We went down with his ship. And I feel like that was the most demoralizing and upsetting part of it all.
Thank you for sharing that. At that time, also, single-use plastic bans started to gain momentum in the US in a way that I'm still trying to unpack. Do you recall when you first heard of, and we're going to get into all the details in a bit, but do you recall when you first heard of single-use plastic bans?
I don't recall the exact moment. I feel like I was definitely on the very early cusp of when they were being proposed and put out there. But I do remember my very initial sense of, uh-oh, what am I personally going to do as someone who personally relies on a lot of them? I am someone specifically with straws and even other single-use utensils and things like that. They're a big part of my personal life with my various collection of disabilities. So I remember just kind of an initial wave of panic. So it was self-focused before it was broader focused. I didn't know initially how realistic they may be. They were kind of just a proposed idea or how far they would get. And I hoped that our voices or sharing experiences like mine, and I knew that other people must have had them as well. I hoped that our voices would carry far enough to kind of shift the landscape before it had a chance to get too much momentum, or that we had considered that or thought about it or thought about different strategies or ways to go about that. I do remember thinking that early on and was, of course, recurrently disappointed to see that I was mistaken in that assumption or hope.
Yeah. For listeners that haven't seen it, the chart lists types of straws from metal to bamboo and health risks from allergies to different types of straws not being positionable. I'll include a link on the podcast website for anyone who wants to find the chart and on Society 6, where you can buy the chart on anything from, I think, like mugs to mouse pads. But before I get ahead of myself, Kaylin, what motivated you then to create this now well-known to at least some of us straw chart?
Initially, it was just pure exhaustion and repetition and resource conservation. Every day, there was a new kind of adolescent alternative idea. Someone created something new that had more problems than the last one did. But I also just wanted a very streamlined, organized, one-stop shop because I was watching myself as well as fellow disabled folks all but fight for their lives in responses that would go on and on and on with the same person. Well, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? As this laundry list of possibilities continued for why that should be acceptable, or what about this style of alternative? And it was happening. These conversations were happening with folks who thought disabled people were all but expendable, and that they should literally be fighting for their lives in the comments. That's often a phrase as used as a joke, but this one felt very real. And watching that happen and watching myself do it and spending so much of my day trying to educate folks on why these things might not work out that way got exhausting and demoralizing and upsetting. And if we could just kind of package it in one nice, convenient way that someone could sit and look at and understand pretty straight away. And even the fact that there are so many categories and so many kinds, just the like visual display of that tells folks who are unfamiliar, we have thought about this. This is a layered and complicated problem. I know that you think you're offering a very simple solution, and it might even be kind-hearted and loving, and coming from a place of I'm trying to help. But I think you'll see pretty straight away, just visually, that we have thought about this. We have done the work. We've put in the time. We have considered these things, and this is actually not a helpful suggestion. But if you sit and look at it, you might end up educated at the end.
Yes, in my social media feed, at least, your chart was a game changer. Even though I still see people try to, and I don't know if the word's able-splain, that there are alternatives to single-use plastic straws, your chart provided a shorthand that honestly felt profound at the time. Was there any particular response to your chart that surprised you, or from your perspective as the person who created it, could you say a little bit about what was the response to that chart?
That's interesting. It surprised me initially because I didn't expect it to travel very far. Like I said, it was just kind of this is for me and my small community around me. This will just help a few people. And then it did grow legs. So that alone, the positive surprised me in a really almost kind of heartwarming way, though, especially that knowing that our community had found value in it and something that I had put a lot of time and effort into, had purpose. I think a lot of us as disability educators or advocates or educators of any kind oftentimes can get very just feel like we're just constantly talking into an echo chamber or just talking to a wall or not being seen. And to actually have something be helpful, get outside our community, have an impact was at that point, especially in time, felt very foreign and very much like we're getting nowhere, anywhere, ever. And so from that point of view, it was definitely positive on many wavelengths. From the negative side, there was still certainly plenty of pushback. Everyone, not everyone, but many people that were still against this or had a different viewpoint liked to try to do the thing that a lot of folks like to do, where they'll try to look for the one thing something missed, try to look for that gotcha, try to go for the one thing. And almost like it became a game for them of like, okay, but what about this? I think I gotcha. And it almost emboldened or kind of intensified the pushback when it would come, as opposed to that kind-hearted, oh, but what about this? That helpful place. It was more like I gotcha now. And so like it kind of came with sometimes even like a level of animosity that kind of threw me for a loop. But I often would end up tagged as loving like credit, but then I would end up seeing the hate or other people, like especially like coming for me for even making it. And so that kind of threw me for a loop as well. I didn't quite expect that.
Your chart to me seemed to provide a pivotal tool for changing public attitudes from assuming, like you said, disabled people had a lack of knowledge of alternative straws to suggesting that perhaps abled people and plastic pollution advocates in particular had a lack of knowledge about disabilities. Your first draft was updated with a couple minor changes, which I think is helpful that you have acknowledged because disabilities are not homogenous or the same for everybody. And I wanted to ask you about that because I love when people publicly own learning
Oh,
and
yeah.
accept that as part of the process. So I'm wondering, what did you learn about straws and disabilities that made you update the chart?
Oh, absolutely. So I would say initially, some of it was in practical response to those new alternatives that were kind of being feverishly created behind the scenes by different companies. And, I think capitalism, we love it. Everyone wanted to like get in with their possible option. I've got a new one. You're going to love this. It will take off. So some of that was a response to that there were just more options. But more than that was certainly the different reasons that folks might not be able to use one, or use one of the different alternatives, or categories that I already had that someone would chime in and say, actually, this is an allergy for me, or this is actually an experience with an injury that I received, or something similar. So a lot of that came in response to hearing more voices with different disabilities and lived experience to me. And there were going to be many of that because there were many alternatives and there are many disabilities and many different symptoms and difficulties. And I certainly don't know them all. I couldn't possibly pretend to, and I think it would be foolish if any of us tried to say that that's the case. And disability is dynamic and in flux and fluid. And until folks had a chance to interact with some of these alternatives as well, they may not have known. Oh, this is a how I did. This is the negative experience that I had with this. So some of it was also out of that. But above all, if it was going to be this one-stop shop and really save folks resources and the demoralization and the exhaustion, it needed additions. It needed to be comprehensive. I could have stopped short, but that wouldn't be helpful to anyone, and it wouldn't really showcase how vast and how complicated and complex this issue is, and the concern is, and how much of a big deal this is, life or death to a lot of people. A lot of concerns are at stake here. And if we're just going to keep it short and simple, then it makes it look like there are short and simple solutions, which there are absolutely not.
When I talk with people and mostly environmentalists who about disability and plastic straws, the question often comes up, why don't disabled people who need them carry them? It's okay if there's a ban and then everyone can just put a tiny, lightweight plastic straw in their bag. Is it true that plastic straws do not take up a lot of room or weight? I mean, it is true, but is this controversy then really about the plastic straw bans, or is it about how disabled people are often ignored, marginalized, or outright demonized in general, or is it about both? Is it really about the plastic straws and about these other questions?
I would say it's definitely both. I think up front, a lot of people will do just about anything to not have to hear or see or consider us if we can be out of sight or mind. I think they would prefer that. So if they don't have to worry about it, if we just carrying them and we'd stop complaining and say that it's impossible, I think that that is the preference right there. And they would also just have to feel less guilty or expend any thoughts our way if we can just take care of it ourselves and they don't need one. So if they don't need one, then they don't have to think about it at all. They could just use a cup and we've got it taken care of on our end. I think that is preferential to a lot of people. But I think there's also just a bare bones lack of education and visibility and knowledge about disability and what our lives are like and how not practical that is. It might seem really simple, and for an abled person, that might actually be a very simple thing to do. But a lot of people just don't know that we already carry so many things with us. We are already keeping track of many a medical device and many, many a concern and a health, just health protection of many different things. They're not aware of that. They haven't had reason to think about that. That we don't always have reliable or consistent transportation. So we can't just keep them in our cars. or haven't really considered the fact that they also just break easily. Throwing them in a bag or in a car or with all the things that we are carrying is not helpful. And a straw is effectively useless if when you pull it out, it is broken. I don't know if you've tried any time recently to use one with a crack in it. It doesn't work. That's not how we science properly. But they've also maybe just not considered that if we're trying to use an alternative, let alone a plastic one, they're really harder to clean or sterilize when you're out in public. That's not going to be helpful. But they cost money that a lot of abled folks maybe haven't considered, that a lot of us are very low income, and that's just not practical and that's not fair. But I think ultimately that's the hallmark of it all. The idea that this is unfair is that they're missing that point up front, is that anything that disproportionately makes us have to do something that they don't have to do, just to drink, just to enjoy a restaurant, just to experience the world as they do, or in many of our cases, to quite literally stay alive, is inherently discriminatory. And that up front should be the issue. That should be the point of contention. And I don't think a lot of abled folks like to have to take that inventory for themselves and realize that something that they're partaking in or don't see as a problem is discriminatory to somebody else. We would all, I think, tend to look away of those kinds of things in our lives.
It also is true that creating plastic straws and plastic waste in general can harm public health, and more often in the global south. Since the intervention by you, Mia Ives-Rubley, whom I also interviewed on this podcast, Alice Wong, and many more, some single-use plastic bans have medical accommodations. What do you make of this compromise between a complete ban and not questioning plastic consumption at all?
That is a fantastic question. I think education and consideration of all sides, both the impact of plastic waste, the impact on disabled communities, I think both sides should absolutely be part of the conversation. I think keeping either of them out is harmful to everyone, to our planet, to our bodies, to each other, to everyone. They all things need to be part of this conversation. I think the biggest lobbying benefits and impact will come when we seek larger companies who are astronomically bigger contributors to plastic production and harm, and not so much on the consumers. I think that the biggest impact and the benefit to our planet will come from really narrowing in our focus on what they can do. But I think consumers still have a responsibility to, where they are able, decrease their consumption. That is absolutely an acceptable and reasonable thing to ask consumers be aware of. They can modify their behavior. If you don't need to use these things, it is not harmful or reductive to ask you to consider not doing so. That's helpful and responsible and thoughtful. At the same time, those who need it should be able to use them. It shouldn't be stripped for all. Harm reduction is a remarkable option. Let's reduce what we can without causing harm to others. This is not an all or nothing issue, and putting sole responsibility on the consumer completely is not only going to have minimal impact, but is going to come at the expense of disabled people. And that is clearly not the answer. But we can still practice harm reduction and encourage folks and educate folks and make folks aware of the changes that they can make if they're able to make them. But that if they're able to make them is absolutely paramount here.
Yeah.
You can
A
do
lot of
both.
people, yeah, thank you. A lot of people listening are environmentalists, as I am. And in my forthcoming book, I define eco-ableism as the marginalization of disabled people through environmental design. That is like the exclusion of disabled people in environmental decision making, as we've been talking about, the discrimination against disabled people through environmental discourses, beliefs, and attitudes. And I'm wondering if you could share a bit, and you spoke to this already, that part of what was so painful during the Trump administration was not just people invoking disability as a punchline, but also people, progressive or liberal people that you might think are would be an ally. And so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your ways of experiencing and resisting eco-ableism.
Yeah, good question. I recently was kind of thinking about this in a broader context and found myself kind of getting stuck on it. I feel like my thoughts in general just haven't been well formulated. I think we've had so many, it's coming from so many angles that it's kind of been hard for my brain to sort it all. So I know that's incredibly ineloquent, but it's all just been very overwhelming and I haven't been able to file it all. It's like when it comes or when I'm exposed to it or seeing it happen in discourse or policy, I've kind of gotten that same frozen, what is happening? How do I interact with this? How do I engage with this? How do I, because it does hit on the personal lived experience, it hits on the kind of work side of things, the energy, the resource, the education side of things. It hits on kind of that global existential, wait a minute, these are the people that I trusted, or that like I'm just, there's just so many layers, and my brain can kind of freeze a bit. So I know that this is important. I think one of the most simple and possible similar things are on conversations around anything that is accessible to us, whether it's, prepackaged foods or prepared foods, things like that. But obviously the single-use plastic utensils, single-use plastic anything, or even just anything that's disposable. A lot of things that are disposable are going to be accessible options to a lot of us. And even down to medical devices themselves, there are people who think that we should that they're causing too much waste. And from IV bags and sterile procedure and all of these kind of bigger things, there have been far too many voices recently that think that even those are wasteful. And if we could just stop needing them, that would be really great for our planet. And when we get big ideas like that out here, though, that's kind of fed into my brain shutting down on this topic in a much broader sense. And so I haven't gotten a well-formulated thought on this. It's all a bit, it's kind of stunned me into that very shut down self-preserve. I can't deal with this right now kind of place, which, like I said, is ineloquent but honest.
No, I am so appreciative of you saying that. I mean, I basically started a podcast and wrote a book because I'm trying to figure it out. I don't, I think anyone that has an easy answer to this question hasn't actually thought about it. And so I really value you saying that because I feel a little less silly for sitting here trying to still learn and grapple with what answers might actually be more just and viable. So one of my favorite people that I've read on this is Giovanna DiCirco, and she calls something eco-normativity. And that's when she's talking about like when anti-toxic pollution scientists and advocates can sound ableist by noting how pollution leads to non-normative health or non-normative notions of gender and sexuality or a whole bunch of things. And part of what I'm really trying to draw out and talking with you and Mia and other experts on disability justice is part of what I heard in this controversy was people assuming that disabled people defending plastic straws were not environmentalists. And I actually don't think that's true, right? And so
Absolutely.
I'm wondering if you have any insights on that, on like if you could say a little bit more about either you as a person or the community having an environmental beliefs. How we still do want to challenge corporations and governments to stop harming health, but we also don't want to become ableist or make ableist policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that has been a really hard thing to communicate. I think when people see that we are kind of in defense of single-use plastics, the automatic assumption is that we don't care what's happening to our planet, that we don't care what's happening to those around us, to the health of those around us, that it is a very self-centered or mindless or uneducated point of view. And I think, ironically, the kind of attack almost on disabled communities has prompted more of us to become more environmentally aware and conscious. I think it has stirred a lot of people to understand, okay, but where is this policy coming from? What is the issue? What, how is this impacting the immediate surroundings that I'm in, especially if I live in an area where these things produce? How is it affecting our oceans? How is it affecting our air? How is it, what is the actual impact on public health? All of these things are big concerns, and because our livelihoods were under attack or at threat, literal threat out of survival, and wanting to know how do we engage with this? How do we find that happy medium? It's forced a lot of us to become more aware. If we weren't already, which I think a lot of us honestly were, and that we're already kind of oftentimes bigger allies or bigger fighters for that than a lot of abled folks are, which is kind of disappointing to see that it seems like we're not that, that that's not the case, that if anything, we're kind of fighting the other side and don't really care about the planet and are, you know, like, which is funny, but it does. I understand why people think that though, when it is kind of a very myopic viewpoint and we are kind of countering, no, we need plastic. It is kind of hard to understand or get into the layers or the nuance and go, wait a minute, what if they actually do understand the planet? That's not your immediate assumption. So I do have empathy that there's some confusion there. But I think there's kind of this just kind of push pull between both sides, because we're also occasionally, as disabled folks, feeling the ignorance and the unintended harm towards us a lot, not only in the actual policy themselves, but in the attitudes around it and in the comments that get made. And while we have, a lot of us have become better aware of mental issues, I can't say the same always from the other side. I don't think a lot of environmentalists have taken the time to become super familiar with disabled lives. And I think it is important. Obviously their causes are important, but I think it's also really important for them to put in some work as well to not perpetuate ideas that being unwell, that having a disability, that having to live in unfavorable conditions, et cetera, is, it's not the end of the world. It's not this terrible atrocity. Because now, of course, if we are making people sick just for the sake of ignorance, irresponsibility, corruption, whatever it is, if we're just doing that willy-nilly, of course, that is not good. And we need to prevent that. We don't want to just create more problems where there don't need to be, or force people into conditions that they don't deserve. But just by nature of having those concerns, similar to above, we often get thrown under the bus with the thing that people are trying to prevent. It's not a pitiable thing. It's not a tragedy. Living the way that we live is not horrifying and the worst thing imaginable in this catastrophic, oh my goodness, situation. Yes, let's work to prevent them if we can. We don't want to perpetuate this again, especially if it's for something silly and it is coming at the expense of, or at the work of corporations and just mindless pollution, of course. But let's be thoughtful in our conversation and how we go about these and include people who do have those concerns as well. Language is important. Policy is important. Thoughtfulness is important. There's a way that we can meet together and work on this together. And I'm not sure that that's happening yet, but we can get there and we should.
I agree. In a recent essay I co-authored with two former students who identify as disabled, we talk about the importance of voice and disability. Do you have another example to share or something you would be willing to elaborate on the importance of including disabled people's voices in decision making rather than speaking on behalf of, or ignoring or marginalizing?
So part of that I would say is very similar to above. I think I don't have my brain often does shut down on some of these things. It's like when I'm in them and I'm focused and I'm kind of in the rallying, I'm in it, I'm familiar, I'm well versed, I'm on the pulse. And then when I'm kind of stepped outside of that worldview and I kind of have to be, I have to think about it again, I'm just so, I get so overwhelmed. And so my specifics are pretty poor at the moment. But the broader context of all that I feel is very similar, whether we were talking about environmental issues and policy there. Having us all come together on the same conversation is really important, whether it's on other direct policy that affects us in all levels of life, all forms of policy that affects disabled lives and the public at large, whether that's transportation, road design, infrastructure, all these kinds of things. We should be included in all of these conversations. And that's how we come up with a collaborative, helpful, productive society that is taking care of everyone, that isn't making things worse for one group disproportionately, but also isn't making things worse for the larger public. And again, creating issues that don't need to be there, creating health issues, creating mental health problems, creating, we don't need to add to problems that don't need to be there. And oftentimes, disabled people are the most preventative thinkers on those things. We also would like to protect the public at large from getting worse because we oftentimes have experience with that. A lot of us weren't born disabled. A lot of us became disabled from other things in our lives, other oversights over just things in our work, in our life, in our cities. We have exposure to that and would also like to not see that same fate happen to anyone else. So we would also like to be preventative. But of course, the language and all of these things, we can all do this stuff together. And I think it would be way more impactful. And then there would be less going back and correcting and amending and fixing and bill changing. We could theoretically kind of get it right the first time. Wouldn't that be ideal? It would be fewer headaches for everybody. That sounds like a great idea. That is incredibly utopic and idyllic and will never happen, but I will champion
I
it.
love that. I love that. All right, I'm going to ask you two questions back, taking us back to Twitter and social media, and then ask you if you have anything you would like to share in, on top of all the many questions I have for you. I could talk to you for hours.
Likewise.
At the time of your straw chart, you already talked about that you had been on social media for a long time, but in 2017, 2018, Twitter
Yeah.
felt like an incredibly important platform.
Yeah.
Why was social media at that time important for disabled people and advocates in particular?
Yeah. I feel like, again, if I go back there in my mind and get out of my frozen trauma brain for a moment, and I remember the really good community strength that was coming there, that was really important as well. I think initially there was that shock that kind of left us all kind of traumatized, but by 2017, I think a lot of us had kind of turned to anger, mobilization, kind of we gotta fight for ourselves now. We can't be stunned and we can't do that anymore. So we are gonna have to do this together. We are gonna have to fight, which is unfair, but it really did create a sense of community that I can't recall having seen quite like that before, despite having been at this for 20 years. I often even myself have felt very much kind of on my own and in my own individual communities, and sometimes maybe as a leader in some of those communities, but didn't quite have the support of everybody else around me. And this felt very different. We all kind of very much mobilized as one, which was really strengthening and I think empowering. And I think showed a lot of other disabled folks that we do have impact, we do have voices, we can get things done, we don't have to stay on the outskirts of society. We can make ourselves visible. We can make differences. We do have value. We are not subhuman. We are important. And that was, I think, a really big turning point for a lot of disabled folks who have that internalized ableism, who have grown up in the same society as the rest of us and have been trained to think less of themselves and less of other disabled people around them. And we're really forced to challenge that. And I think we saw a lot of progress there. I think we saw more compassion for one another, and in that education, learned more about each other's disabilities, learned more about the ways that these issues impact one another, which ended up being just really good advocacy and education to a whole lot of different illnesses, conditions, life circumstances, marginalizations, just different intersections that we all kind of may not have had reason to know about or should be shown ourselves. But outside our community, I feel like the same thing was happening. It was a chance for abled voices to kind of experience a lot of the same thing. And unfortunately, it was kind of unfortunately, some of it happened because it was an issue they were also forced to care about a little bit as well. They, especially when it was something like straws, they were inconvenienced too. A lot of them didn't like that. No one likes a paper straw. I don't care who you are. That's the leading cause. And literally no human on this planet has ever liked a paper straw. We are all in agreement on that. We found the one thing we can all agree on, that they are awful. And I think when it comes to abled people in particular, they had to kind of care about it before their lives were changed. And they kind of looking around for answers and looking for people to commiserate with. And you got a strong community and us over here, no one's commiserating stronger, and it that brought them into our world. They were forced to care, and they got the same kind of education and exposure, and were forced to also kind of become a little bit more compassionate and understanding and realize how big of a deal that this is impacting their life, but it is severely impacting ours. And I think they had their privileges checked and but they're also their biases checked. Got the same educational experiences, and just all these things that I felt like were really missing. And even in taking jabs at the president, or the president taking jabs at us, for a lot of them, that was a unifying thing too, to be like, we don't tolerate that. We don't like that. We'll defend you on this one, and kind of became educated in that as well. Some, of course, took the other side that was sad to see and kind of missed the memo. But a lot of others did the education themselves too and were like, oh, wait a minute. I didn't realize I was contributing to that. And I really don't like it when he does it. So why am I okay with it when I or the people around me do it? Actually, you know what? I take that back. I learned. That was happening too. That was happening actually a lot. And I think it was a little easy to get lost in the other side, but that absolutely happened. And that was a big year to start that I hadn't really witnessed before.
Since Musk bought Twitter, things have changed. Do you think Twitter's still an important platform for disabled networks of care? Are there other social media platforms that people could tune into that are becoming more salient for those networks?
Yeah. So interestingly, so the Musk experience, I feel like that should all be capitalized, has been interesting. It has certainly made for a more hostile environment for anyone who has a marginalization of any kind. I think we all have understood that. And with disabled people being pretty far down on the rung to a lot of people, I think it has been pretty rough of a transition for our community. So it is definitely not the environment that it used to be. And it doesn't feel as safe of a discourse and as productive of a discourse. But to be honest, I feel like even pre-Musk, some of that was waning. I feel like especially once the pandemic began, I think we all kind of saw pretty quickly how much that positivity from 2017 there on, it went away pretty quickly once 2020 hit. And the lives of disabled people and even just the health of everyone around became the absolute lowest priority that anyone could possibly consider. And in trying to fight for that, it didn't go well often. But now that we are where we are in 2023,
the exhaustion and the burnout and the ability for anyone to care has understandably, it's just waned. People's tolerance for anything has just been obliterated. Everyone is tired, and I cannot blame nor fault anyone for that. No matter who you are, how you live, what's going on, we are all so fatigued, so traumatized, so burnt out that the ability to just be compassionate and thoughtful and have productive conversation on any platform, anywhere, in any medium is struggling. And that's no different whether it's on Twitter or any platform or anywhere. You throw a musk into the fire and it just kind of flames things. But yeah, so that is true. But I still feel like Twitter in particular is at times a bit more of a better platform than others. There are a lot of physicians. There's a lot of science there. There's a lot of credentials there. The ability and the desire for people to cite their sources is there more. Communities are sometimes a little tighter over there. There's a diversity of voices that all kind of meets in the middle there more so than other platforms. While there's a lot of good conversation that happens on places like Instagram and you often get a very patient-centered, personal experience, which is definitely good and has a ton of merit. It's not quite the same for science and policy. Like, it doesn't quite happen to the same precision. So then you kind of get a lot of things get lost in the shuffle. Sources don't get cited hardly ever. Links don't even work there. So things kind of fall to the wayside there. Same problems over on TikTok. Same kind of experience, TikTok specifically, though I feel like there is a strengthening disability community in some ways over there that is very robust and lush and productive. There's also a huge breeding ground for misinformation and, again, badly sourced information. It's a little bit of a dumpster fire over there that has not gone checked yet. It is too brand new. So that's troubling. Facebook has always been troubling for lots of things, and that's it. There's value in some places and some pockets, but they are very niche pockets and places. So at the moment, I feel like we're kind of in a lost zone of community, though some things are budding. A lot of them are new and kind of working out the kinks. And I don't think we have I feel like we're kind of on an island. We're stuck. We're struggling. But unfortunately, I gotta say, Musk or not, I feel like Twitter is still a solid as it's what we've got. Mm-hmm. It's crumbs and it's pennies, but it's something.
In closing, is there anything else you'd like to share for this particular podcast on these topics?
Great question. I feel like we have been super, super thorough. But I will maybe add as a final thought. I know when talking about kind of where to go and how anybody else can make a difference, or you know, who to follow, who to look to, what kind of response can we have to this? I think not everything is futile. We do have options. We can make things better. I think it's hard when you're on outside of a community of how do I educate myself? How do I get in? How do I understand these issues? Where do I even begin? Even when you yourself are disabled, it is it's overwhelming. And where do you start? It's so complex. And I don't have easy answers for that, but I do think that curating your own feed, seeking it out, making an effort always goes better than not. Expecting these things to come to you organically is nearsighted. It's not going to happen. It won't. It just won't. And if you just make a little bit, even if it's something as simple as a Google search of who are the best disability advocates to look for, even if it is rudimentary as that, you will probably get a decent start. And if you start with some bigger names, it might not always be top tier. Everybody who comes with a big name and a big platform always has flaws and errors. That's how it always is. But that's okay. If you go in knowing that, you'll still get some fantastic introductory information. We've all got to have a ground floor somewhere. We've all got to have a disability 101 somewhere. You'll get positive exposure. Start there. You'll start finding pockets that interest you, that excite you, that ignite a passion. Someone might be policy. Someone might be environment. Someone might be the intersection of that. Someone might be like myself, which is a lot of mental health and lived experience and communication with the public. You'll find the thing that speaks to you, and then you'll want to learn all about it. You don't have to know everything about every topic. That can't happen. It won't happen. Don't set yourself up for failure by trying. Find the thing that you're really good at or that really interests you and get as much as you can. And that is a huge positive impact and goes really far. And I think that's the best place that people can start. And even if it is starting there, listen to the voices that they listen to and who they recommend. Follow the people that now you're following. Like, that's how you get your foot in the door and feel like a more educated, compassionate, thoughtful, just consumer and person and human and friend and all that. I think there is a lot of good that we still have to give and can gain and can learn. And I'm going to focus on that part and less the things that have brought us to some of these conversations.
Well, much gratitude to you, Kaylin. Hell on Wheels has got to be one of the best monikers ever. And I just appreciate you taking time with me and my own curiosity. So thank you so much.
You've been wonderful.